Okay, we're beginning here with the two dots on the top of Samach Zayin Amud Aleph. Here they're quoting from the end of the Mishnah, Zeh Klal. This is the principle, Kol Shebehana Tok Benotein Tam, that any time something is Notein Tam L'Shvach, then it is problematic. If it's Notein Tam L'Fgam, then it is not problematic. It does not make the item Asur. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Hochi Hilchato. This is the Halacha. Again, it's a little strange that the Gemara is saying this is the Halacha. We really haven't found anybody who argues on this principle so far. We will see later on in today's daf that there is one Tana who argues on that position. And even though really the halacha is like this because there's a Stam Mishnah that says it, nevertheless the Ritva says that Rabbi Yehuda is coming to dispel the possibility that Rabbi Meir was found on the second half of today's daf, who's of the opinion in Notein Tam Livgam is Asur. And it's a very logical and compelling position that don't think that the halacha is like Rabbi Meir. Rather, it's like this Stam Mishnah, despite the appeal of the position of Rabbi Meir. Despite the fact that you might think the other view is more logical, the halacha is, or the majority view is, that Notein Tam Lifgam is not problematic, Notein Tam Lishvach is problematic. That's only true when we speak about that which is mentioned in the Mishnah, that the chometz is considered to be notein tam lifgam when it falls into the grisin, into the groats or the grits. That's only true when the groats or the grits are hot. Nafal l'tok grisim tzonanim, if they fell into cold grits or groats, where the chometz is an improvement, and actually, whether it soaks in it, it marinates in it, and it improves the flavor, or it acts in some way to, quote-unquote, cook the item, Vehir tichan, and then after the fact he heats them up. Then it's a case where it was notein tam l'shvach up front because it fell into them when it was cold. Ulibsof pagam, then when he heats up the item afterwards, that's what causes the begam, and it's a sore because of the hashbacha that happened up front. Chain tiyata rabin amar rabbi barchana amar rabbi yochanan. So this memra we have first of all from Yehuda amar Shmuel, which means that it's in Bavel we have the Memra. Now we're getting the same Memra from Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael, where we have Rabin bringing it in the name of Rabbi Barchana in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. That's only true if the chometz fell into groats that were heated up. It falls into groats or grits that are cold. And then afterwards he heats them up. And it's as if it's something that was improved, then in the end deteriorated, ve'asur, and that is problematic. V'chein ki ata rabdimi, so rabdimi also, and then it says, v'chulei, brought the same misora from Rabbi Yochanan. We have Rabin and Rabdimi who travel between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, and they bring many of the memorot of Eretz Yisrael, especially those of Rabbi Yochanan, to Bavel. So here you have both of them bringing the same memra in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. And then finally we have Kakayu Osim Barvei Shabbatot B'Tzipori. This is also what they did Erev Shabbat in Tzipori, Bikorin Otan Shichlaim. And they called them cress. It looks like they soaked the grisim, the grits of the groats, in chometz, and maybe even left them in there for a period of time going into Shabbat for a long duration, meaning that coming into Shabbat they marinated them in the chometz, left them there till the next day, and then they were edible in that state. Whether they actually heated them up afterwards and then left them heated up, or they just left them in that state, seems to be that that was an enhancement, and that's also an indication of the idea that putting chometz into the cold item is beneficial, or the fact that you put it into a cold item, then heat it up and leave it for Shabbat, that's also considered to be shvach, because otherwise they wouldn't have done that in Tzipori on Shabbat. So that's an indication that this type of process is a positive process. Right, so we'll work our way backwards. First of all, what does that mean that they called them cress? They're not cress. So why would you call these legumes with chometz in them cress? So the Bali Tosfot note, the fisha yirigilim, laniach bo chometz, kamo b'shichlaim. That the normal way to eat shichlaim, to eat cress, was with vinegar in it. And so then this dish, which had the grisim, the grits of the groats in chometz, was similar in nature to this shichlaim. And that's why they called it shichlaim, because it was similar to the dish or it had vinegar in it, or that was a major component of the dish. The second thing is that, now the Bali Tosfot are perplexed by the use of the language of Naseh Kamosh Yishbiach. What does it mean it's as if it is Mashbiach? It is Mashbiach. The Lashon Naseh is a very strange language over here, because it should say, this is the fact. The fact is that it improves it up front, and then it ruins it in the back end. So why does it say Naseh? It's as if that happened. So the Baal Tosafot say, Yesh Lamar, because the truth is that the whole benefit is not till after they have heated up and then cooled down again. That it's not enough that you simply put it in the cold groats or grits, that doesn't prove it. But the real improvement happens when you heat them up afterwards and then cool them down again. So the vinegar is placed in before they're heated up. They are heated up and then they are cooled down. That's when it is positive. And that actually would reinforce why you think there's a problem over here, because here the heating up afterwards, even though it makes it into a pagam, it's really just a short-term pagam, and then it makes the shevach in the back end. And that's why it's nasek mishishbiach. It's as if it is mashbiach, improves it, and then it gets deteriorated, but then the real shevach is the end result of that, which is once they cool down again, then you have real shevach. And that's why the initial stage of shevach is only called Nasek Mishish Biach, because you still need the remaining processing to get it to the point where it's real Shabbach, when it cools down after being heated up afterwards. So those are the memorot of these Amoraim. So here you have a slight alteration on what we've seen before. Before we had Notein Tam L'Shabbach, problematic. Notein Tam L'Fgam, it's not a problem. Over here we have where it has both properties to it. It has the property of Notein Tam L'Shabbach, and also has a property of Notein Tam Leaf gum. So again, if it's notein tam leaf gum, that's the case where you put it into the hot. We've seen it, that there's no question that it doesn't affect it, or it's not a problem, because it would be notein tam leaf gum, and it is quote unquote batel. It doesn't affect the item because it's ruining the taste of the item. On the other hand, if you first put it into the cold, we've seen it. So even though those we've seen it now will heat up, which is a positive, and then they will have the vinegar in them while they're heated up, which is a little bit of a negative. Then it's nasek mishish biach ulusof begam. It's a hashbacha up front. It is beneficial to them. In the back end, it is negative for them. So the question is, how do we view something like that? And the answer is, we say that it is notein tam l'shevach, and it is asur, even though there's a begam aspect in the back end. And from the way that the Baal Tosafot read it, is sounds like there's a hashbacha up front, then there's a begam, and then in the way back end, there's another shvach, that it's actually beneficial in the long run. So you have periods of time where it's beneficial, period of times where it's negative. We still consider it as if it's the shvach, because of the fact that it is nasek, emishish, biach, l'sof, begam, v'asur. And we let the hashbachah is the overwhelming utility of this chometz in this case, and therefore it's going to be asur, as if it is notein tam l'shvach. The Rambam actually extrapolates this din and says it's not only true when it's Yishbiach Udusof Pagam, but even a case where it's Pagam Udusof Yishbiach. In that case of the Rambam, many believe that's only true if it actually is Mashbiach in the end. It's not enough that it is Pagam and it will get to Hashbacha. It actually has to reach that point of Hashbacha. Although the Pri Chodosh says in that view of the Rambam that even if it is yet to become Mashubach, but it will become a shevach in the future, then it's still a sur at this point in time, because embedded in that notein tam l'fgam is the potential for shevach, and therefore it takes on that shevach. So the Rambam really expands what's being said in the Gemara here, does not take it literally like many of the Rishonim do, which is it's in shbiach ulusof pagam, because over there the hashbacha came about at first, but it extends it to the opposite direction, which is pagam v'achrakach hashbiach. Even though up front it's begam, and therefore it should be considered to be heter up front, nevertheless, it can switch over to being isur. And the question for the editor, it actually has to be mashbiach in order for it to be isur, is actually a machlok between the shach and the pri chodosh. All right. So then it says, Amrei shlokish, notein tam lifgam, she'amiru, lo shi'umru kadei rezu, chasera melach, yitera melach, chasere tablin, yitera tablin, so here you have a statement of Reish Lakish. There's going to be Nika Damri in a second about Reish Lakish. The only thing you know about this first Lashon is that it's Lakumra. The second Lashon is Vika Damri. Am Reish Lakish, no tein tam lifgan shamru. Ein omrim gder zu chasera melach, yitera melach, chasera tablin, yitera tablin. But here at this point already has ruined it. And only thing you know about the second Lashon of Reish Lakish is that it is the Kula. So you have two Lashonot in Reish Lakish, modifying or qualifying Notein Tam Livgam. And then you have the Rishonim argue about exactly what is the Kula and the Chumrah here. Rashi says the Kula is that in the first case, Reish Lakish says that if you have something added to the pot or whatever you are cooking, and that is Notein Tam Livgam, it ruins the flavor. It is detrimental to whatever you are cooking. But it is not so detrimental that it can't be cured. That means that if you taste it now, you say, you know what? Could use a little more salt. Could use a little more spice. A little less spice, a little less salt. I mean that there is a way to rectify whatever happened here when it obtained the time we've come. It is ruining the pot. It is ruining whatever's there. But not in a way that you wouldn't eat it anymore. You might say, look, it's edible, but I would love to have a little more spice. It's edible, I'd love to have a little less salt in it. So either you can rectify it, or it's edible in that state, even though you would have preferred it to be in a different state. In that case, Reish Lakish says, that's not called Notein Tam Lifgam. Notein Tam Lifgam is when it's not missing anything, and in a chelet mipnei zeh. And this item, this Notein Tam Lifgam, is what ruins it. It ruins it to the point where you won't eat it, and it's a case where you will not be able to rectify the problem. And that's when it's called Notein Tam Lifgam, because that is a permanent problem or deterioration in the flavor of the item because of what that was added to it. And that is called Notein Tam Lifgam. Now that's the Chumrah, because that narrows the scope of Notein Tam Lifgam. Notein Tam Lifgam before we thought was anything that was negative, detrimental. Now we're saying that, well, can't not just that, it has to be so detrimental that nobody would eat it because of this item. And you wouldn't just say, you know what, it could use some spice, but I can eat it. Or I could spice it now, and then it would be fine. That doesn't count as Notein Tam Lifgam. On the other hand, V'Igadamre, according to this, is if it's Notein Tam Lifgam, if in any way it ruins the taste or the flavor of the item, that's already called Notein Tam Lifgam. You don't have to say, because of this item, I will no longer eat it. Even if you say, wow, it's a little salty now that this item's in it. It needs more salt because it's in here. Or I could rectify it by doing that. Or it's a little spicy now. Or it's a little less spicy now. I would eat it, but it did ruin the flavor. It would taste it better before this item got in there. Nevertheless, that's called Notein Tam Lifgam. So that's a big kula. Does that mean Notein Tam Lifgam means if it makes any change in the flavor that is not beneficial or is negative, then that's enough to deem it as Notein Tam Lifgam. So that's the way Rashi learns that the first Lashon of Reish Lakish is saying that Notein Tam Lifgam is going to be so gum that you won't eat the item anymore. The second Lashon says anything detrimental, and again, even if it can be rectified, or even if you would eat it anyway, it's still considered to be Notein Tam Lifgam. Yes, and therefore in all of these cases, Notein Tam Lifgam would then not make the item masur, and you could eat it if the item fell in and gave it this bad flavor. The Balei HaTosafot basically uphold what Rashi says and say something very similar. Rashi over here qualifies the aspect of Einan Echelet Lav Davka. It means that's not literally not eaten. The Kevin de Bekimata Purto Karile Einan Echelet. If it causes some deterioration in the flavor, that's already called something Einan Echelet. Or in essence, what we're saying is if there was enough of this here, it wouldn't be eaten. So therefore, when there's a smaller amount of it here and it ruins the flavor, that's enough to consider Notein Tam Lifgam. So it doesn't literally have to be not eaten. It just has to be that this is the type of flavor that ruins it. And if you continue to increase that flavor, you wouldn't eat it at all. But in the current state, even though you would eat it, since it ruined or detracted from the flavor, that's considered or classified as Notein Tam Lifgam. That also leads the Ritva to suggest over here that Notein Tam Lifgam is not something where you have to be able to discern it. Doesn't mean that every layperson is able to figure out whether it's Notein Tam Lifgam or not. And that's partly, we're going to see later on in the sugya here, that there are going to be Notein Tam Lifgam applies even moments after the item has been absorbed into the walls of the kelim. And over there, nobody's really going to be able to discern it. But we know that chemically, that's what's happening, and we know that that's what's impacting the item. And if you increase the intensity of that, it would be a pagam. And that's enough to make a Notein Tam Lifgam, even if a lay person cannot taste or distinguish that. Nevertheless, we have a Masora, or experts in this area could taste it, and therefore that already is considered to be Notein Tam Lifgam. In a slightly different view, the Those of both read explains here that the first Lashon of Reish Lakish is a case where we know already that the item had a problematic taste to it, and this only serves to accentuate that problem. So in the first Lashon of Reish Lakish, that is not enough to make it no tin tam lifgam, because it already had a flavor lifgam beforehand. And just because this increases it, that's not considered to be no tin tam lifgam. As opposed to the second Lashon that doesn't worry about the fact that it's already pagam. If this serves only to increase the pagam, that's enough to make it that it's no tin tam lifgam, and that's why it would be mutar. Alright, now the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yubau, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Kol shita'amo umamasho asur vilokim alav. Anything where its flavor, as well as the actual item itself, is asur, and if one consumed it, they would be chayav malkot. Then zeu kezayit b'gdei achilat pras. This is subject to the rule of kezayit b'gdei achilat pras. This is a measurement that is significant halachically, and it's based on the Gemara in Eruvin and the Mishnayot in Nigaim, which gives certain sizes of consumption for determining time periods. So one of them is for the entering into a house of Nigaim. You enter into a house of Nigaim, the way that the Torah phrases it says, well, if you sit in the house, you're going to be Tameh, and if you eat in the house, you're going to be Tameh. And so the Chazal ask about that. Well, if you're going to sit in the house to be Tameh, then of course, if you eat in the house, you're going to be Tameh. It seems obvious. So Chazal darshan from that it doesn't literally mean you have to eat in there. The eating in the house was the shiur of time you need to be in the house in order to be Tameh. And so that is what's called achilat pras kikar, that you have to eat when you go into the Beit HaMinugah. So over there, the Mishnah and the Gemara in Eruvin also has a list of items. And it talks about a loaf of bread for Eruvin. Half of that loaf of bread is for Beit HaMinugah, Yudei Achilat Pras. So you have all of these items that are listed based on that amount of food. There, the Mishnah gives you the quantity of the bread based on the price and the ingredients that you're putting into it. Derives from the kikar, a loaf of bread that was eaten in the time of the Gemara, and it is actually the shi'ur for Erev Tchumin, which is that by Erev Tchumin, the Chazal say that you have to have mazon shtei se'udot, you have to have enough for an individual to eat two se'udot in order for that to be the minimum amount of food that is used in Erev Tchumin, and there Chazal give you the measurements, the Gemara and Erevin, for what that is. Here, it's kadei achilat pras. The word pras means half. So it is half of the amount that is used by Erev Tchumin, meaning that it's mazon shtei sudot. This would be mazon suda achat. That is the kadei achilat pras. That is the measurement of time that you have to consume this kezayit. That is a threshold of time that has halachic significance, as we're going to explain. But Rashi over here explains to you that kedei achilat pras is four beitzim. Rambam argues on Rashi and says that it actually is three beitzim and not four beitzim. And obviously that has nafkamino as to how long you think the amount of time of kedei achilat pras is. But based on wherever you think in Erevin, where there's a machloket about the size, both in the Gemara and in the Rishonim, between Rashi and the Rambam, then when you have kedei achilat pras, you're going to have that same machloket, just at half the amount. And here Rashi says that it's four beitzim. And the Rambam says that it is three beitzim. In terms of the modern post-game, kedei achilat pras runs anywhere from 3 minutes to 9 minutes. Generally, when we're speaking about kiyum mitzvot, we speak about on the chumrah side of saying that it has to be in a less of a period of time, which means anywhere from about 2.5 minutes to 4 minutes. That's the view, or the range of view of the post-game. And then on the other side of the chumrah d'oraita, which is things like a chola that's eating a Yom Kippur, that needs to spread out the isur, over there the post keep talking about anywhere from 4.5 to 9 minutes. So that's where you get this range of about 3 to 9 minutes. And then the amount of time it takes you to consume that item, that is the measurement of a halachic window. For nigaim, it's how long you have to be in the house to become tamei. And for us over here, it means in which period of time you have to consume the isur for it to be considered isur. If you have a tarovet, you have a mixture in which you have stuff that is heter, and then stuff that is isur that fell into the heter. Now, if you have that, there's a dilution of the isur. So when you go to eat whatever it is, are you consuming enough isur to be chayav? In order to be chayav, a consumption of the isur, you have to eat a kazayit's worth. Over how much time is it considered to be that you've eaten a kazayit? What happens if I eat a half kazayit today and a half kazayit tomorrow? Nobody will say that those are mitzareif to make you chayav. If you eat a half kazayit now, and 30 seconds later you eat another half kazayit, most circumstances that will be mitzareif. Now you have two items that are mitzareif, and it would for sure be considered a kazayit. What is the cutoff for making it into one unit? And that is what the Gemara is noting over here. It's kedei achilat pras. The amount of time it takes you to consume for a kibetza worth of bread in that period of time. If you consume the kazayit of the isur, then you are chayav. If you go beyond that point of time, then you're not chayav, maybe asur, because we pass them like Rabbi Yochanan in the Gemara and Yoma, that chatzi shiur is osur min haTorah. So eating less than that is problematic, but you won't get malkot for it, because you didn't reach the threshold of a kazayit within the period, designated period of time to consume that kazayit. And so then this kedei achilat pras becomes important. We're coming again into Pesach. It's important with regards to achilat matzah. One has to eat a kazayit of matzah. The same thing applies by mitzvot as it applies to isurim, which is that if you have to eat a kazayit worth of matzah, you have to eat it within the period of time of kedei achilat pras. If you eat over a longer period of time, then the kazayit is not mitzareif to get you to the kazayit of matzah that you need to consume. And so then kedei achilat pras also plays a role in determining how long you have to eat the matzah. Again, there should be some correlation between the two. There are different opinions with regards to the size of a kazayit, and different opinions that are with regards to the amount of time you have to consume the kazayit, meaning the amount of time of kedei achilat pras. In general, and this should be the case, is that the larger you think the kazayit is, the longer you think you should have that the kedei achilat pras should be. And the larger you make your kazayit, the larger you're going to make your kibetzot. The larger you make your kibetzot, the longer it's going to take you to consume the bread. So by definition, it should be that there's a relationship between the size of the kazayit and the amount of time that you have. And that's why it doesn't always make so much sense to be machmir for both sides. To be machmir for the biggest shear of kazayit and the smallest shear of kedei achilat pras. Some people try to do that on Pesach when they're eating the matzah, but in some ways that's illogical because it wouldn't make sense to have the biggest kazayit and the smallest amount of time to consume it. There has to be some relationship between the kazayit and the size of the kazayit and the size of the kibetzot and the amount of time that it takes you to consume it. Now that may not be a perfect correlation, therefore it may make sense to have the relationship not be exactly what the opinions are, but maybe the chumrah a little bit, but to go to the extremes seems a little strange in those situations, given the fact that there should be a correlation between them. Even though you do have this window of kazayit b'dei achilat pras, generally we favor doing the mitzvah in a way that you eat the kazayit either in one shot or on a continuous basis without having to be mitzareif b'dei achilat pras. There, achilat pras then can be seen more as a dispensation rather than the ikur halakha, and that's why people try to eat a kazayit. Some even try to eat a kazayit in one shot, or eat a kazayit on a continuous basis, not use the kedei achilat pras as the mechanism for me mitzareif the kazayit. Now, tamo below me masho, you're talking about tam, there's flavor that's imparted by the item, but the item itself is not there, the end. It's not actually tangible. Asur, if you consume that flavor, then you are doing something that is asur, vain looking a lot. On the other hand, you're not going to get malkot for it. Now Rashi over here says, when it comes to tamo v'loma masho, kagon chalav, dinafalik deira, milk that fell into a pot of basar, o chelev shenafal limoach, or fat that was melted that fell into the pot, so that's where mamasho is no longer discernible, but rather tamo, only the flavor is there, not the item itself. Rashi, both from what he's hinting to here in this Rashi, as well as more explicitly in the Gemara in Chulin, Rashi believes from this Gemara you see that tam ki ikar lav deoraita. Tam ki ikar is a principle that the Gemara gives that the flavoring of an item is the equivalent of the item itself being there. That's the whole basis for the concept of isurim here when something flavors another item. And that is not only do we see the flavor as giving over something that's asur, ki ikar, we see it as if the original item is there. Tam ki ikar. What Rashi says from our Gemara over here, it makes it sound like tam ki ikar is lav deoraita, is not min haTorah. Because in the first series it says, kosher tamo imumasho asur velokin alav. When you have flavor and you have the actual object intact, it's asur and you get malkot for it. Because there, the isur is be'en. It's tangible, it's there. On the other hand, when you say in the second piece here, it says, tamo velo mamasho. It's not at its flavor where the object or the isur is no longer tangible. It's an intangible taste. There it says it's asur. Rashi says asur mi derabanan. They ain't lokin alav. That's why you don't get malkot over here. It's because tam ki ikar, or the concept of tam being something that is problematic, is only a din derabanan. So Rashi, based on this Gemara and a number of other proofs, tries to say that tam ki ikar is lav deoraita. It's only mi derabanan. The result of that is exactly what you're seeing in our Gemara here, which is when it has mamashut, when it's the tangible isur, you get malkot. When it's the intangible flavor, you don't get malkot. It might be asur midrabanan, but you don't get any malkot for that. Now, the Balei Tosafot bring Shitat Rashi. They first of all say, even within Shitat Rashi, Rashi has to agree that by basar v'chalav, tam ki ikar d'oraita. Even Rashi, who believes that tam ki ikar is only midrabanan, by basar b'chalav, you have to say that because of the principle that we noted already, that derech bishul asra Torah. The Torah asered basar b'chalav in the lot v'shel gedi b'chalei bimo, in the way that it is cooked. And the normal way to cook it is to flavor one with the other, and that means that flavor would be problematic. And so the Balei Tosafot say that Rashi, over here where he brings the example of the chalav and the chalev, the chalav example is incorrect. The chalev example would be correct, the Rashi, the Shita toh. It says, even Rashi in his own Shita has to distinguish or differentiate between basar b'chalav and other isurim. But then the Rabbeinu Tam comes along and one by one knocks off the proofs of Rashi and comes to the conclusion against his grandfather that tam ki ikar is d'oraita. That tam ki ikar is a Torah principle, and therefore where tam is given, you have an isur d'oraita. The problem is how to read our Gemara over here. Our Gemara says, tamo v'lo mamasho asur v'ein lokin alav. That's very supportive of Rashi's contention. So here, the Rabbeinu Tam gives different reasoning behind this, and that is, v'hayi d'hocha. The reason over here, the tamo v'lo mamasho mairi b'min b'mino. It's a case where the two items are of a similar nature. Bato b'ruba midoraito. Because min b'mino is batel b'rov minatorah. Because by definition, min b'mino doesn't give flavor, the concept of notein tam by min b'mino is a rabbinic imposition. Minatorah is batel b'rov. And so what the Rabbeinu Tam says is, tamo velo mamasho, tam ki ikar, that's a din d'oraita. Now, with regards to ein lokin alav, that's because in this case, it's a unique case of tam. And that is min b'mino. And in min b'mino, tam is not relevant. Therefore, min haTorah, it's batel b'rov. Not b'tam, but rather b'rov. And that's why over here, ein lokin alav. Because there's no malkot when it comes to tam from min b'mino, because tam is not relevant by min b'mino. And that's why if it does give over flavor, but it's the minority, it would be batel midoraita, no malkot. It's asur midrabanan because of the superimposition of this notein tam concept on min b'mino. Now, the little problem with that is that if it's min b'mino, it shouldn't matter whether it's just the flavor or it's even the item, tangible item that's there. And that's what he says. Even if the isur was there, you wouldn't get malkot. Unless you can discern what the isur is. And it taught you the chiddush over here is that even though it's tam without mamashut, it's still asur midrabanan. And that's the chiddush over here. And another reason it wrote tamo v'lo mamasho is because that's milta de psikai. In that case, it's always asur midrabanan because you don't have to explain the ein makiro, that he doesn't recognize it. Because if you wrote tamo v'mamasho, then you would have to explain that if he can find the item or he can discern the isur, then it's asur midoraita and you get malkot. If he can't discern the isur, then it's only asur midrabanan. And then ein ekwokin alav. So if you had written tamo v'mamasho, you'd have to write it's tamo v'masho the ein makiro. So rather than doing that, it just simply wrote tamo, which is also an isur derabanan. And that is the view of the Rabbeinu Tam now, that tam ki ikar is a din d'oraita. Our case here of why tam ki ikar is not d'oraita is because it's min b'mino, Mimino is not a world of tam because it's the same flavors. You can't speak about tam. The fact that the chamim do speak about tam is all it did derabonon, and that's why over here it says assuming the rabbanan in a case where the heter is the rove, but the tam is still there. So in that case, the oraita ain't looking alive because of min bimino. But me the rabbanan, it's a sore because of no tein tam. But that's why you don't get malkot. Had it been that it was min she'eno mino, then you would have gotten malkot because tam ki kar me the oraita. Although the Rabbeinu Eliyahu tries to give another version or explanation of this, built on what the Rabbeinu Tam says, saying that the whole Gemara here is saying that min she'eno mino. And then the case of Tamo Mamasho is a case where you have ikizai betoi kidei achilat pras. And Tamo v'lo Mamasho means that you don't have ikizai betoi achilat pras. It's in other words. Tamo Mamasho means you do have ikizai betoi achilat pras. And Tamo v'lo Mamasho means you do not have ikizai betoi achilat pras. That's much more of a forced reading of the Gemara, but in that way you can read it as being min she'eno mino. And even in the case of min she'eno mino, you're not going to get malkot when you don't have ikizai betoi achilat pras. Although the Rabbeinu Yosef tries to explain the whole Gemara now as min she'eno mino, and even in a case where there's kedei achilat pras by both of them, and yet you still don't end up with malkot. So he's taking up the position of the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rabbeinu Eliyahu, but he wants to explain the reading of the Gemara in an easier way, which is everything is kedei achilat pras. By tamo mamasho you get malkot, because that's a dito right, the min she'eno mino, even b'min b'mino, if you can be makirit, if you eat a kzai b'deach kala pras, you're going to get malkot. In a case of tamo v'lo mamasho, tam ki kar is a din d'oraita. Where do we learn that from? Gi'ulei obdei kochavim. We learn that from the kelim of Midian. Over there, it's only an assay. The assay is that you have to remove the isur from the item. And based on that, you won't get malkot because tam ki kar d'oraita is only an isur assay. And that's why there are no malkot. But Rabbeinu Tam says he disagrees with that. Because in the end, what the din of Midian tells you is that when you have flavor in the pots, there's still asur, which means that it's still nevela, and it's still basar v'chalav, it's still all the problems that you had before. It's not teaching you a new din of isur based on tam ki kar. Tam ki kar tells you the flavors that are imported here have the din of the original item. And that means now you're violating chazir, you're violating nevela, you're violating basar v'chalav. And that's why you should get malkot. Even though it's an assay that returns these items, they're basically established that these items are still in their state of Isur. If they're in their state of Isur, then you're under the lav that's associated with them, and that's why you would get malkot. For that reason, the Rabbeinu Tam rejects this view of the Rabbeinu Yosef. Bimriba tam lifgam mutar. So here it's a strange statement, which sounds like, if you are merabeh tam lifgam, then it's asur. Lema. Let him just say, even atan tam lifgam mutar. Why did you just say, if it gives a bad flavor to it, then it is mutar, like we've said all along. What does this mean, riba? Hakamash v'lan. Da'apagav de'ika mile achranaita de'pagma behadei. Even though there are other items causing a deterioration in the flavor besides the item of Easter that's there, then it's still considered to be notein tam lifgam. So that's what it says here. Riba. It increased the negativity associated with this food. This food already had a problem with it. It wasn't spiced enough. It didn't have enough salt on it. And then you added this isur in, came in, and then made it even worse. Or made the flavor even more problematic. It's still mutar, because the hilchata kalishna batra the Reish Lakish. That's what that statement is telling you, that the loch is like the second lashon of Reish Lakish, which is the lashon le kula. And so too over here, when it says riba lifgam, means that even if it's increasing the negativity associated with it, it'll still be mutar, even though the item was already problematic before you started, or it was inedible, quote unquote, like we said before you started, because the flavor was already not so good, and this just increases the problem. So according to the first lashon of Reish Lakish, that would not be called notein tam lifgam, because the item is already tasting bad without this, or that something that you could have rectified, and therefore it's not problematic. Whereas over here, but whereas this version, which is going like the Kula Reish Lakish, means that even if there was something wrong with it, but this increased the problem, then that is still considered to be notein tam lifgam. So Amar Rav Kahana, midivrei kulam. From all of these memorot, you can see in Rashi lists them, we had first Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, which is the beginning of our sugya, Rabba Bar Bar Chana in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, and then that was brought by Rabin, then we had Rav Dimi bringing a similar lashon. Then we had the two Lushonot of Reish Lakish. And then we just had Rabbi Abahu, who's quoting in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, about Tamal B'Mahasho and Tamal B'Lo Mahasho. According to all of these Amoraim, Notein Tam Lifgam Mutar. Everybody agrees Notein Tam Lifgam is Mutar, which actually makes the statement at the beginning of the sugi a little stranger, which is, why do you have to pass an alofa is Notein Tam Lifgam is Mutar? Seems that it's a consensus view that Notein Tam Lifgam is Mutar. And you could say, Midivrei Kulan, from all of them, all these Amoraim that's made statements, it's clear that they think Notein Tam Lifgam is Mutar. Amalei Abaye Bishlama Mikulhu Lechayet. From all of the Amoraim, I agree with you. I understand why you would say that. Ella, the Reish Lakish, I'm not so certain that you're right. Because Amru Ke'amar Velelo Svirle. Because over there it says, that's what they say, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he agrees with it. So if you look back at Reish Lakish's statement, we read it in a way that just made it sound like that was Reish Lakish's opinion. If you look very carefully, it says, Amar Reish Lakish, Notein Tam Lifgam She'amru. That's what they say about Notein Tam Lifgam. This is the qualification. Why did he phrase it in that way? Why didn't he just say, Notein Tam Lifgam Mutar? And this is the rule, or this is the qualification, B'Midvarim Amurim, this is the qualification of it. The way he phrased it is, you know, those guys that say, Notein Tam Lifgam, it has this qualification about it. It makes it sound like he's assigning that opinion to someone else, and then explaining it, but that is indicative of the fact that he does not hold of that opinion. And that's the diuk that Abaye is making, which is the fact that he used the Lashon of Amru, means that that's what they say, but that's not what I say. And therefore, I don't know if you can be Midayek, but Kahano, Midivrei Kulam. Not everybody says that. Reish Lakish disagrees. Michlal, Teika Laman Damar Notein Tam Lifgam Asur. So if what you're suggesting now is that Reish Lakish subscribes to some position that is Notein Tam Lifgam is still asur. Is there such an opinion? Does that really exist? And as Tosafot points out, even though we have other sources that indicate that there are positions like this of Notein Tam Lifgam, we don't have any explicit reference to the Tana that actually is sober that, and that's what the Gemara is searching for over here, which is who is the named Tana or explicit Tana that suggests that Notein Tam Lifgam is asur. Gemara says in, yes it does exist, v'atanya, and we have a braita that will show us that. Echad notein tam lifgam, ve'echad notein tam lishvach, asur, divi Rabbi Meir. Here you have it explicitly, Rabbi Meir believes that whether it's notein tam lifgam or notein tam lishvach, it is considered to be asur. So there you see, now you have an opinion that notein tam lifgam is asur. Rabbi Shimon Omer, this is the opinion we're more familiar with than the opinion that we've had in our Mishnah, which is l'shvach asur, if it's a beneficial, good flavor that's being added in, then it is problematic. With gum, if it gives a detrimental flavor to it, then it is mutar. So here you see that there is a Tana, Rabbi Meir, who believes notein tam l'gam is asur, and Reish Lakish could be subscribing to that position of Rabbi Meir. I'll just say as a side note that the diuk that Abaye makes is not so strong. The phraseology of Reish Lakish is not definitive that he is saying, they hold, I don't hold. It could just be the principle that Chazal or the Mishnah laid out, that Notein Tam Lifgam is asur, this is the qualification of it. That doesn't indicate necessarily, or you don't have to say that that indicates anything about his opinion. He just might be saying it that way because it's not his own opinion. It's what Chazal said. It's what he got from the Mishnah. And now he's just defining that, but it's not to exclude himself from that opinion. And what you have to say is that either Abaye had a Masorah in that way, or he felt that it was strong enough a reason to suggest that maybe Reish Lakish doesn't hold that way, and therefore you can't come to a definitive conclusion that Reish Lakish really holds that way. So just as a sidebar, that it's not as strong a diuk as you would like, but nevertheless, the Gemara was searching for a Tana who has that opinion. The Gemara says, we do have a Tana like that, which is Rabbi Meir. Now Gemara wants to know, my taimo de Rabbi Meir, what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Meir's position? Gamar migu'ulei obdei kochavim. He learns it out from the kashering of the pots or the items that they got from Midian. After the battle with Midian, it speaks in the Torah of all the booty and the shalal that they brought back. And then there are instructions that are given about how to deal with it. Kol asher yavo be'esh tavi'u be'esh v'taher ach v'meidei da'yit chata. Anything that went through the fire, you have to put through the fire. Anything that went through water or went through heat, heated water, cooked in water, has to go through heated water. Anything that was used with sonain has to just be rinsed down. And that is the principle that is otherwise known as kibolo kach poto. In the way that it absorbs, that is the way that it exudes. So the kashering that you need to do in order to kasher these pots, the same way they were utilized, if you reuse them in that way, without anything in them, you put them through fire, if they were put on the fire, that will cause the flavor to be exuded and kasher the item. The case of Midyan, you're speaking about pots and pans and frying pans and all sorts of things that came from individuals who were eating stuff that was not kosher. And for that reason, you need to kasher the kelim when you bring them back from the war. And that's what's being spoken about here. He says he learned some gilei ovdei kochavim, because in that case, gilei kochavim lav notein tam lifgamu, even though the gilei ovdei kochavim was notein tam lifgam, how does he know that? Because stam kelim inam b'nei yoman. We have a principle. It does have halachic ramifications, which is, we assume that most kelim inam b'nei yoman. That is subject to a machloket as to whether inam b'nei yoman means that it wasn't used overnight, meaning it sat a night without being used, or whether inam b'nei yoman means made late 24-hour period that it would sat and was not used. We're machloket for the opinion that says inam b'nei yoman means 24 hours, and that's where we think the threshold is between b'nei yoman and inam b'nei yoman. There's a big difference, and we'll see this in the Gemara today and a little further on in the Perek as well, which is that within the first 24 hours, the time in general is considered to be a beneficial time. After 24 hours elapse, there's an assumption that einan bnei yoman, they're not of this day, and then the flavor that's in them starts to deteriorate, or is notein tam lifgam. For that reason, if a kli is einu bnei yomo, it's much easier to deal with it, because in general the flavors notein tam lifgam, and then you have a lot more maneuverability or kulot that you can use. For instance, when we're kashering kelim for Pesach, they always tell you to leave them for 24 hours and then kasher them afterwards. Because once you make them inam b'nei yoman, that gives you a huge advantage in terms of the kashering, which is that even if the kashering is not perfect, it's already notein tam lifgam. And given that, you have a lot more latitude to deal with it. And that's why you always wait 24 hours of non-use of the item and then you kasher. So what Rabbi Meir is saying is that the kelim from Midyan could have easily been einan b'nei yoman, and yet it still says you have to kasher them. That shows you that notein tam lifgam is still problematic and needs to be kashered. So therefore it makes no difference whether it's notein tam lifgam or the shvach, since in Midyan you have to kasher them. That makes it sound like they are problematic in either case. V'idach, Rabbi Shimon disagrees with them. How is he going to deal with that? He hold like Rav Huna b'reid Rav Chiya. Dam Rav Huna b'reid Rav Chiya. Lo asfatorah al kedera bat yoma. The only thing the Torah restricted is a kedera, a utensil that was used within the last 24 hours. Delo livgamo, because that is not something where the flavor has deteriorated. Implicit in Rav Gana's statement, first of all, is that if it's beyond 24 hours, it is no dein tam livgam. The second thing you learn from here is that the case by Midyan means that all the kelim that they were getting from Midyan that they had to kasher were kelim that were used in the last 24 hours. How he knows that is not clear, but he has a misora that that was the case. If that's true, then the only reason they're kashering them is because they were notein tam l'shvach. It's within 24 hours of them last being used. It was already beyond 24 hours, in Ochanami, they would not need to be kashered because it would be notein tam lifgam. We are in general gozer, inu b'nei yoman, because of b'nei yoman. If we follow this to the letter of the law, that means that anytime you're beyond 24 hours, you can switch the pot from being a milchik pot to a fleishik pot, and from a fleishik pot to be a milchik pot. You don't need two sets of dishes. You can even do it possibly by Pesach, if there's no mamashut there. Even though chametz is a problem with mashu, before Pesach, it's not a problem with mashu, and that's the regular dinim of bitul. And therefore you could switch the back and forth between the pots as long as you waited 24 hours. The problem is, it's an easy area to make a mistake. It's a little before 24 hours, after 24 hours, I don't remember when I used it, I didn't use it, I did use it. By the time you're done with that, people are going to start mixing them up, and then you're going to get real issues, d'oraita, basar b'chalav, and other things where the time is real within the 24 hours. So we, to avoid that problem, Unto Bnei Yoman, we worry about Enum Bnei Yoman, even when it's 24 hours, we still don't do it, the Chatchila at least. Bidi Abad, there's a lot more latitude when it's Enum Bnei Yoman, and usually that'll be the first question that any Rav asks you when you call the Kashrut question, did you use it in the last 24 hours before this happened? And the second question I'll ask you is, was there a Dover Harif there? Because that changes the whole game, which we'll see later on. So now, the Edok, now, what does Rabbi Meir do with this Mesora of Rabbuna Breid, Rabbi Chia? He says, Edok, Hedera Bat Yoman, Nami, Iev Shar Delo Pagma Purta. According to Rabbi Meir, even within the first 24 hours, there's some deterioration in the flavor. The flavor is at its peak at the time that the pot was used. The flavor that is now in the walls of the pot is on a steady decline. It doesn't happen that you hit 24 hours and there's a cliff and all of a sudden it becomes pagam. What's happening is from the moment you've stopped cooking in it, the flavor deteriorates. Now, what Chazal are saying, once you cross the threshold of 24 hours, it's clearly the pagam. Before 24 hours, it's still the shvach, but it's a declining line of the shvach. So what Rabbi Meir says, even in a bat yoma, there's still a negative or a notein tam lifgam aspect to it. And because of that, even bat yoma will teach you the same lesson, which is notein tam lifgam is still problematic. Rabbi Shimon, my time up. So now, Rabbi Shimon was responding to Rabbi Meir's proofs. What's the underlying thesis of Rabbi Shimon? The Tanya, lo tochlu kol nevela, la gersha bisharecha tidnena v'achala, umachor lenachrit v'yam kadosh atal Hashem lokecha, lo tevashel gidi b'chalei v'imo. Says you may not consume any nevela. You should give it to the ger. Here's the ger toshav. This we spoke about when we discussed ger toshav. He's entitled to the nevelot. Actually, machloket in the Tanaim as to whether you have a choice to give it to a ger toshav and sell it to a nachri. Does the Torah give you an order and tell you to first give it to the ger toshav only if that's not available to you to sell it to nachri? Or is the Torah indifferent between those two options? You can sell it to the nachri or give it to the ger toshav. That's one of the entitlements of the ger toshav. And as you see, there's a strong correlation between the titnena of achala that you give it to the ger toshav and he will eat it. And that is the diuk that basically Rabbi Shimon's making out of the posuk, which is kol haruya the ger kruya nevela. Anything that is edible or consumed by the ger, that's called a nevela. She'ena ruya the ger, meaning that if it's already gone bad or deteriorated to the point where it's pagam, then it's not called in a kriya nevela. It's no longer called a nevela. So even though it started out as a nevela, if it deteriorates and the ger wouldn't eat it anyway because of the negative flavor that is associated with it, then it no longer is considered to be the isur of nevela anymore. It's no longer a nevela. And that's exactly conceptually what we're saying about notein tam lifgam. Notein tam lifgam is not isur. It's as if it doesn't exist as isur anymore. Rabbi Meir, how's Rabbi Meir going to respond to that proof of Rabbi Shimon? How the milte swucha miikara. That comes to exclude a case where it's bad from the outset. The example that Rashi gives is, the animal while it's alive is a mukat shchin, that's already a sickly animal, then that's mufka minivela, because before you shechted it, it wasn't edible. So then when you shechted it, it doesn't become edible, meaning that it was mufka from nevela before it ever became a nevela. But that means Rabbi Meir is implying that if it did become a nevela, then it can't lose the shame nevela so easily. In a case where it's already inedible when it's alive, then you shechted it, it never became a nevela. But in a case where you shechted a healthy animal and it became a nevela, and then afterwards that nevela deteriorated, Rabbi Meir says you can't lose the shame nevela so easily. The threshold usually is until it's not ruya lechilat behema. Meaning that if it starts out as being ruya lechilat adam, it's edible by human beings, then even if it deteriorates, it won't lose its shame of isur, or sometimes the shame tuma, until it's then no longer edible by behema. So even though it loses the capacity to be eaten by nadam, it still remains or takes that shame. And that's Rabbi Meir's position that nevela remains a nevela, period, even when it's notein tam difgam. Rabbi Shimon, srucha miikara lo tzricha miuta. If it's already srucha miikara, where it's bad from the outset, even while it's alive, it's still bad. You don't need a pasuk for that. Afra ba'al mahu. That's just like dust of the earth. That's like dirt. There's no reason even to classify that as an isur, or even think it's an isur. You're not even speaking about something that is consumable. And therefore, you don't need a special pasuk to tell you that. So here you have the positions of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon. The Bali Tosafot discuss what is Rabbi Shimon's position with regards to a Kli Bat Yoma. Rabbi Meir makes a statement here that even a Kli Bat Yoma, Eifshar Delo Pagma Purta. It can't be that it didn't deteriorate somewhat. That's based on the fact that there's a certain amount of linearity to the deterioration in the flavor till it reaches the point of Enu Ben Yomo, or the 24-hour threshold. And so Rabbi Meir says that it's impossible that there's not some pagam over here. So the Bali HaTosafot bring two views within the Bali HaTosafot. One view is the fact that Rabbi Shimon disagrees completely with Rabbi Meir, and he disagrees with the fact that there is any pagam. He believes that literally in the Ben Yomo, there is no pagam whatsoever in the flavor. The flavor is still the shvach, and there is no deterioration in the flavor whatsoever. And they are arguing on a very fundamental point as to whether there is pagam in the first 24 hours or in the Ben Yomo period. And from that, he comes up with the fact that there is actually then a three-way machlokin in this matter, because we actually have the Chachamim arguing Rabbi Kiva and Psachim that give a different view than Rabbi Shimon. And if that's the case, you actually have three different Tanaim arguing about this position. The three-way machloket here with regards to notin tam nifgam. The Rabbi Meir, the Shmaitin, Rabbi Meir over here in our sugya, sabar kol notin tam nifgam masur. Any negative flavor is still problematic. Afil shu pagum, even if it is fully pagum, gam ksha iser be'ein, even if the iser is still there, the yalfilah the gamre mi gulei uvdei kochavim. He learns out the entire source from gulei uvdei kochavim. And that means that any pagam is still problematic, or no matter how pagam it is, still problematic. And he doesn't have the source of nevela to mitigate his position. Rabbi Shimon matir kol pagam. Rabbi Shimon's matir any deterioration. Even if it's a benefit, but there's some pagam in there. Even if it's around, even if it's ben. Kevin da'ashto the pagam hu shori. Since now it is negative in its flavor, then it's problematic. The yafli leaf the gamri mnevela. His source entirely is from nevela. He doesn't learn out of midran at all. So that is what we saw in our Gemara, that Rabbi Meir is focused on gulei ovdei chochavim, the kelim of midran. Rabbi Shimon is focused on nevela. But they don't mitigate their position with the other Tana's view. On the other hand, Rabbona de Psachim, Rabbanim Sachim de Pelige Rabbi Akiva Sabre, the Davashu Pagam, Shaiser Be'ain Shari. In a case where there's a negative flavor, and the Iser is still around, that is Mutar. Jeflinan mi Nevela. They learn out from the Nevela that an item that loses its flavor no longer has the Iser associated with it. Avab Gam de Hashto, Shaina Iser Be'ain. You're talking about flavor where the Iser is no longer around, and then the flavor is deteriorating. When the Isur was still around, it was the Shevach. It only started to deteriorate because you took away the Isur, and now the flavor over time deteriorates Asur. They learn that out of Midyan. So the Chachamim, who are going to Rabbi Kiva and Psachim, take Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon, and they say, listen, when the item is still intact, and it deteriorates while it's still that item, then the Veilah now loses its flavor or starts to deteriorate, they're going to agree with Rabbi Shimon that that's no din tam nifgam, and it loses its shame in nevela, and it's not a sur anymore. On the other hand, if the nevela is perfectly good, it imparted flavor to the pot, and the tam is deteriorating just because it's tam, but the nevela is still intact, and the nevela's flavor and taste is still all there, then they're going to agree with Rabbi Meir that that type of no din tam nifgam is a sur, because there the begam is only a derivative of time and it being a flavor, but the actual object of isur is still a sur, it still remains that way. And so in that way they'll agree with Rabbi Meir and they'll focus on gulei ovdei kochavim, learning it from midyan. On the other hand, there's another set of the Bali HaTosafot that believe that Rabbi Shimon is synonymous with those Rabbonon in the Gemara Psachim, and he agrees that there is a begam port over here. What he disagrees with is whether you can extrapolate from that. Rabbi Meir is saying, well, if there's a small amount of pagam and you see it, it's still a sur, that means that any pagam is a sur. Rabbi Shimon says you have to differentiate. When there's a small amount of pagam, then it might be a sur. When there's a larger amount of pagam, that might be a totally different case or situation. You can't learn from Gi'ulei Ovdei Kochavim about a small pagam to teach us about something that is a large pagan. And so he agrees fundamentally with what Rabbi Meir is saying. He's disagreeing with the application of that, where Rabbi Meir takes that and then extends it to all pagam. Rabbi Shimon says that's just not true. You can differentiate between small pagam and large pagam, and therefore even if it's a small pagam in Ben Yomo, that does not equate with the large pagam of Einu Ben Yomo, and no pagam would still be mutar, despite the fact that there's a small pagam in the flavor even during the first 24-hour period. So the Baalei Tosafot go back and forth between these opinions, bringing proofs to either side, and also trying to establish Rabbi Shimon's opinion with regards to other matters that we know, like from the Gemara in Makot, where Rabbi Shimon says that you get Makot even in a koshu, as well as whether you need the Pasuk of Mishrat to teach you that Heter Mitztaref Leisur. All these other factors play into this discussion as to what Rabbi Shimon's opinion is over here. Okay, we're going to stop here, four lines down on the top of Samachet Amud Aleph.